Greetings, friends. It's me, D. Trussell, reporting into you from Tacoma, Washington. If you happen to be listening to this the week of March 10th, I hope you'll come see me. I'm at the Tacoma Comedy Club. And then March 31st, I'm going to be at the Helium Comedy Club in Portland for that weekend. Then April 15th, praise God, I'm going to be in Austin, Texas at the Vulcan Gas Company. And then May 13th, I'll be seeing you at Copper Blues in Phoenix. Lots more dates coming up. You can always check DuckaTrussell.com to see where I'm going to be headed. Today's guest is Radelle Weininger. And what's wonderful about her is that she's a psychotherapist who has studied all the Western modalities and spent time as a monastic studying Buddhism. People like her are so important because they act as translators who can take some of the esoteric ideas that show up in the Eastern traditions and communicate them using the relatively newer language of psychotherapy. A lot of what I learned from Ram Dass comes from my friends telling me the mystical things he told them, really beautiful ideas about the soul and ego identity. He even gave some of them spiritual names. But the core bit of advice he gave to me was, you need therapy, which I didn't take seriously, but I definitely wish I had. I spent years after he told me that, haphazardly meditating and going through various embarrassing spiritual phases until finally after my second kid, I realized that I couldn't go on being so neurotic and angry and wobbly and freakish and weird and secretly resentful, waking up in the middle of the night, gritting my teeth, having vivid, strange memories coming back from my childhood in the midst of psychedelic experiences. And I found a great therapist who helped me deal with some of that stuff that I had been unsuccessfully sweeping under the rug. And now I'm a perfect, completely healthy, balanced individual with no problems at all. The cosmology of the East is so vast that it is easy to overlook whatever particular incarnation you happen to be going through. Why worry about your childhood when it is but one of an infinity of childhoods? It's the kind of thinking that leads to what's called spiritual bypass, where rather than deal with the painful realities of this life, you turn your eyes towards infinity and pretend that you aren't absolutely nuts. What I love about Ram Dass is what I love about Radelle. They're both mystical therapists who took the obscure, sometimes incredibly confusing ideas of the East and the obscure, sometimes incredibly confusing concepts that show up in Western psychology and synthesize them into something that is powerful and pragmatic and most importantly, accessible. I can't even say accessible. Accessible for dummies like me. We're going to jump right into this episode with Radelle, but first this. A big thank you to Athletic Greens, not just for supporting my podcast, feeding my family, bringing food to the beautiful lips of my children and my wife, but also for keeping me healthy. I'm not a vitamin guy. I don't know how to do it. I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to do the thing where I buy a bunch of different vitamins and then put them in little packets and then or throw them all in a Ziploc bag and take big heaping scoops of vitamins like I'm a rhino at a zoo being fed by vets. I need something simple or I'll forget, something that tastes good or I won't put it in my body. And that's what's awesome about Athletic Greens. It's just one delicious scoop of vitamins that have everything you need. 75 high quality vitamins, minerals, whole food source superfoods, probiotics and adaptogens. And even better, you don't have to know what any of those things are or think about it because Athletic Greens does it for you. That's what's glorious about it. All I care about is it makes me feel better. I've got more energy. I sleep better. It costs less than $3 a day. It's cheaper than getting all the different supplements yourself. And you're investing, of course, in the number one insurance, which is your own health. And these days, let's face it, we need our vitamins. Right now, it's time to reclaim your health and arm your immune system with convenient daily nutrition. It's just one scoop and a cup of water every day. That's it. No need for millions of different pills and supplements to look out for your health. And to make it easy, Athletic Greens is going to give you a free one-year supply of immune-supporting vitamin D and five free travel packs with your first purchase. All you have to do is visit athleticgreens.com/Duncan. Again, that's athleticgreens.com/Duncan to take ownership over your health and pick up the ultimate daily nutritional insurance. Thank you, Athletic Greens. And now, everybody, please welcome to the DTFH, Radelle Weineker. Welcome to the DTFH. I'm very excited to chat with you, and I'm very sorry for the turbulence preceding whatever this conversation is going to end up being.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
So you are a really great writer, very incredibly talented at translating some ideas that I've run upon in Buddhism in a way that's like I can connect to them more. And I wonder if we could just start off with the basics. Can you tell us what a LERP is?
Okay. A LERP is a long-standing, recurrent, painful pattern. And I think in the past, they have been talked about by Jung and Freud as complexes. Or in the East, they were called samskaras, or I think in Pali, shankaras.
Yep.
And so there are these knots in our psyche, these wounds, these splinters in the flesh that are just sitting there. And then, you know, there are behaviors and feelings and memories and traumas at the core. And then events and behaviors and relationships all come together in these knots. And I think in the East, they call them seeds, you know, that are there kind of implanted. And when the right or the wrong causes and conditions come about, then they kind of come to flourish or blow up or however we want to call it.
That part, that's the problem. I don't mind the seeds themselves. They might be a little uncomfortable, but it's the blow up part. The unexpected blow up part that is, for me, incredibly problematic. I got kids, I'm married, I can't do these unexpected blow ups. You know, it's just, this is why I'm in therapy. Are you there? We left off talking about these seeds, time bombs, karmic time bombs, or something that just for me, when I'm meditating and anytime I start thinking, this is it, you're getting enlightened. I'm like, oh no, that means I'm a few days away from one of these things exploding out of me and my wife going, you meditated today. Why are you acting like this? The seeds are exploding, Aaron. So I've been very curious about this idea of karmic seeds. And I would love to hear your thinking regarding if it's possible to get them out. And I know this is a question that pops up in a lot of traditions in a lot of different ways, but what are your thoughts on that? Can we change our karma? Can we get the seeds out before they sprout?
Well, I think it's kind of more a longer term endeavor. When I'm now, meditating, I started 1980 when I was really young in a monastery in Sri Lanka. And I started pretty much around that same time psychotherapy. You know, I had two car accidents. I was, you know, a young student. And
wow.
So I started then. And I have to say life has gotten easier. And when I get triggered around abandonment or rejection or feeling left out, my pet lerps, then it seems that these LERPs are not anymore in the driver's seat.
Right.
You know, they are more like in the back seat, or maybe at some times I think they're in the trailer, but then they kind of clap over. And
yeah. Yeah. LERPs. Yeah. I mean, I sometimes when I'm going to my therapist, who does, I love that I can never remember the name of it, EMDR.
Yeah.
I wonder to myself, is this just something that Buddha stumbled upon, this way, the way trauma gets stored in us in the meditative process? Is it just a way of sort of doing trauma work that, but it's the symbol set because of the time period it comes from is sort of mystical and seems kind of magical, when in fact it's just an early form of dealing with trauma. Do you have any thoughts in that regard?
Yeah, it's right. It is a way of dealing with trauma. And, you know, I have my own suspicion about the Buddha. You know, the Buddha's mom died when he was just a few days old.
Right.
And even though every scholar says, oh, it was not a big deal, he had a good stepmom, it is a big deal.
Huge.
And then, you know, having this dad who's kind of controlling, you know, who doesn't ever have him go out and play, you know, man, that I'm sure he had his LERPs. Man, you can just hear the story and think, oh, wow, this boy is going to rebel, right? And so it makes sense that he went out and looked for freedom, you know, when his dad said, oh, there is no suffering, you know. When he had lost his mom, he had a controlling dad. He said, no way, I don't believe that.
God bless you, ExpressVPN, for supporting the DTFH. Have you ever stopped to wonder why internet access is so much cheaper these days, like $30 to $40 a month? It's because internet service providers aren't just making money off subscription fees. They're also making money from spying on your internet activity and selling your history and data to big tech companies. So what's the best way to make sure that 100% of your data is encrypted and that your ISP can't get a hold of it? You guessed it, ExpressVPN. ExpressVPN creates a secure tunnel between all of your devices and the internet so that everything you do online is encrypted. It reroutes your connection through a secure server. This blocks your ISP from seeing everything that you do online. All they can see is you're connected to an ExpressVPN server, but nothing beyond that. And when they see that, they weep tears into the piles of money that they're making from spying on everybody else. And it's not just for your phone or computer. ExpressVPN works on all your devices. It works on your tablets, smart TVs, even your router, so your entire family can always stay protected. You can't stress this enough. ExpressVPN is so simple to use. This is why I love it. You just open up the app, tap one button to connect, and that's it. Your data is your business. Protect it at expressvpn.com/Duncan. Visit expressvpn.com/Duncan to get 3 extra months of ExpressVPN protection for free. That's expressvpn.com/Duncan to learn more. Thank you, ExpressVPN.
You know, when his dad said, oh, there is no suffering, you know, when he had lost his mom, he had a controlling dad. He said, no way, I don't believe that.
Right. He goes out to the forest, picks up an eating disorder, almost dies. I really, that is what happened. I'm sure as a therapist, when you're looking at that, it's a kid who is suffering from the trauma of losing the genetic mother. My wife has become really interested in the trauma of adoption, and even in surrogate parents, how apparently this is like really difficult for it. You can't just give birth to a child and then hand the child off and expect that the child doesn't know that this is a different person than the being it's been within while it's, you know, growing. So yeah, I never thought of that. Like, yeah, suddenly he's got a stepmom. His dad is like abusively controlling, you could even say. Like, this is, he wants him to be a warlord, and he's keeping him locked inside. So yeah, wow, that's amazing. You that's a very interesting and controversial take on the psychology of the Buddha.
Well, you know, when my mom hid me in a children's home for 2 years because she was scared of her Catholic family. And then kind of said she had adopted me, you know. So talk about trauma. And, you know, people had come through the war, you know, they were in Germany. And, you know, it was really... talk about transgenerational trauma. So I don't know. I feel with the Buddha.
Yeah, I do. I do too. I just have never made, you know, I love that you're making the connection. You know, one of the things I love about Jesus is this is a Messiah that's kind of trying to get out of the deal. You know, in the Garden of Gethsemane, he's like, I'm not into this. Is there any way out? Finding a loophole. I find that to be the most human, beautiful response to a terrible destiny. But with the Buddha, it's easy in these stories that he sort of gets mythologized as almost a perfect all the way through, just this perfect, flawless being, at least from the versions of it that I've read. So I love this idea of a kid who's just pissed at his dad, who's trying to differentiate or something.
Well, and then when you look at it, the Buddha had a lot more time than Jesus. Jesus had 3 years. The Buddha had supposedly 40 years.
Oh.
You know, so he had time to work on his lerps.
Wow, right. He did have more time. Unless you buy into the mystery school Jesus stuff, which who knows, but that's not the point. The point is, these in all wisdom traditions and in modern psychology, there is the identification of these kinds of tangles that end up within us. You know, some of the traditions, the tangles happen lifetimes ago. Some of the traditions, it's epigenetic. This is the West's version of reincarnation, is we have epigenetic lerps within us. But regardless, there's some possibility of no longer being controlled by these things and experiencing some form of liberation. Can you summarize your technique for dissolving? Or I know you have many steps, and I thought maybe we could just run through them a little bit.
Sure. You know, you know, I'm a clinical psychologist, and I'm a meditation teacher for, you know, even longer than a psychologist. And so I try to bring both of it together, because I think as Westerners, we need both understandings. You know, the Buddhist way is very process focused, very just... see the impermanence of it,
yes,
and the emptiness of it, and the West is very much, so what actually happened with your mother? And so we need a little bit of both, you know. We need to be heard what actually happened. You know, you can't just say, oh, just get detached and I disidentify, or it's all empty or so. You know, it just doesn't hit the spot. And on the other hand, we could easily get stuck there without changing really the way our life flows. So I try to find a path, especially with these long-standing patterns. And that's the other thing I felt, that sometimes in our mindfulness literature, we don't talk about long-standing patterns. You know, we talk about moment by moment, non-judgmental awareness.
Yes.
But the deep stuff, yes, Buddhist scholars and people really who dig into it know about it, but we stay with the moment by moment. So now come back to anger arising and passing away. So I often didn't feel, actually Jack Kornfield, who's my mentor for over 20 years, he has been very great. You know, he has been very
interested
in my, you know, in my path and my wounds. So I see he was really wonderful. But we need to be understood and we need to move on and create new neural pathways and new habit patterns.
Yes.
And so the way I would do this is the first step is to know that we have gotten lurked, you know, and we know this in our bodies, you know, how it feels like, maybe a knot in the stomach or tightness in the chest or in the jaw or hot or cold, or we lose all our energy, or maybe there's too much energy, and then maybe strong emotions that are bigger than maybe a situation would expect.
Right. You
know, why did you make such a big deal over this? It was just a little thing. And then rumination, you know, getting off into the spinning thing forever.
Yes.
It's really important. And then our usual trauma responses, such as nightmares, dissociating, you know, narrowing of awareness, all of that. So it's important to notice we have gotten lurked. And it's a little bit like saying, okay, you have a staph infection. You know, like I was a medical doctor in my first life. So,
wow.
You know, like medical model a little bit, you know, yes, we have this. And so now we know what we can do about it.
Right.
We have a diagnosis, you know, this is a lurk. And then, you know, what we learn from moment by moment, mindful awareness of our body, of our thoughts, of our feelings, and knowing that everything is passing by. You know, everything is impermanent and comes and goes, and that we can stay with our feelings. That is okay. If we just stay with the felt sense of our feelings, then like a people mover in the airport, they slowly pass on. And, you know, so mindfulness is really important, mindful awareness. And then awareness as something which I learned more from my Tibetan trained teachers, that awareness is also something that is just a priori there, you know, that is not just moment by moment. And so that awareness is also something that we can rest in, you know, something you might have felt in a long retreat.
Sure.
We have glimpses, you know, when awareness breaks through in nature, at a long retreat, making love or whatever, you know, we do for this timeless, formless moment to occur.
This episode of the DTFH has been supported by my favorite CBD company, Feels. Feels, it's a better way to feel better. Their premium CBD will keep your head clear and help you feel your best. CBD has been proven to greatly reduce anxiety, pain, and for me, sleeplessness. It's premium CBD delivered directly to your doorstep. What does premium CBD mean? It means it's a beautiful amber tincture, like something elves would make, as opposed to some of the vile, briny, alkaloid, garbage tasting, awful CBD that you can get out there where you put it on your tongue and it feels like you just popped a leprous gnome in your mouth. I love feels. It helps me sleep. It helps me relax. You just put a few drops of it under your tongue and you can feel the difference within minutes. Even better, if you don't know much about CBD, they have a free CBD hotline to help guide your personal experience to figure out what kind of dosage you need. Feels works naturally to help you feel better. It's not addictive. It just works. And it's wonderful. There's no hangover. You're not going to get high. You don't have to worry about getting paranoid. It just chills you out. It's awesome. Joining the Feels monthly membership makes your self-care easy. You'll save money on every order and you can pause or cancel at any time. Start feeling better with Feels. Become a member today by going to feels.com/family hour and you'll get 50% off your first order with free shipping. That's feals.com/family hour to become a member and get 50% automatically taken off your first order with free shipping. feels.com/family hour. Thank you, Feels. Sure.
We have glimpses, you know, when awareness breaks through in nature, at a long retreat, making love or whatever, you know, we do for this timeless, formless moment to occur.
And may I stop you there for a moment?
Yeah.
Number one, doesn't happen to me when I'm making love. Not obviously not bragging about that. Not a good sign. Number two, I'm curious because you, anytime I get a chance to chat with someone who has an understanding of Western psychology and Western medicine and as much of an understanding of Eastern mysticism, particularly Buddhism, I'm always curious about your thoughts regarding awareness as a, what do they say, unconditioned awareness, a kind of fundamental quality of emptiness. Do you have any thoughts regarding the biological nature of awareness? In other words, do you think that awareness is a byproduct of being a having a nervous system, a complex nervous system, or are we? Do you? What are your thoughts regarding awareness? Is it some endogenous biological result?
You know, I don't know. I think. You know, I've been studying now, I studied for 15 years also with Alan Wallace and then with Dan Brown.
Yes, yes. I mean, these are superstars, yes.
Yeah, so I'm Dan Brown. For the last 5 years, I'm, I don't know, 6 one-week seminars a year. You know, he's getting old and his health isn't good, so I do everything. You know, he's just an amazing teacher. And so the more, and he's both a psychologist and a really amazing teacher. So I come to think that awareness is something that is already there.
Yeah.
You know, that everything is interconnected, that awareness isn't something that's just located in our prefrontal cortex, that we actually can unhook from our prefrontal cortex manager mind and rest in this wider perspective. And the more I'm learning this, these pointing out instructions, and I'm really getting the hang of it, I think they have incredible health benefits. You know, if yes, we can really rest in this wider place of awareness, and live our life from that. I think we have to be aware that we shouldn't use that to escape. I think that sometimes happens. You know, people say, oh, awareness, bye-bye world, you know.
Yeah.
Universes come, universes go. But I think it's important that we bring it back, you know, in a loving, engaged way. So, and then I think, you know, my husband is a hospice doctor, hospice palliative care doctor, and he meditates that way. Every day he goes to the hospital. He meditates while he walks for 2.5 miles to the hospital.
Wow.
And so, and then he says he's able to be there in resting in this field, you know, it was incredibly difficult situations. And so I think as life may get harder in the future, there's a good possibility with climate change, whatever's going on.
You're in a body. If you're in a body,
it's hard.
Probably life's going to get harder in the future. You could guarantee if the UFOs come and reseed the earth and fix the climate and all wars stop, if you're in a human body, you know, these things fall apart.
Right. And so I think if we have this perspective of having our mindfulness skills moment by moment, but also the resting in the wider perspective skills, kind of connecting into this field of awareness that is already there, or this quality, then I think we can be so much more effective and don't get burned out. And I think as bodhisattvas, or as, you know, with our service, we can be, you know, really be present without taking it so personal.
I really love that you mentioned this possibility, which I've only heard one other time when I was reading about monastic life. I think I was on a forum for monks or people who want to become monks. There was something in there about how, like, some monks, and I can't remember which particular lineage of Buddhism it was, but some monks were actually getting scolded because they were only going into the awareness field or only going into the state of nirvana. And they were saying, like, you know, this can be an addiction. Like, once you learn how to do it, you can disconnect, just like what you're saying. I wonder if you could talk about that a little more. How deep have you gone into that state of consciousness? Have you ever gone through periods of finding yourself addicted to that, whatever you want, oceanic emptiness, the unconditioned awareness?
Yeah, I could say, especially on long retreats, you know, that I figured out, even though they were Theravadan retreats, I guess I figured out how to get into this place of awareness. And so I just remember just being there and not wanting to go home. You know, it's like, can I stay? And I seem to have had, maybe because of my orphanage experience, or I had this big accident and a bit of a near-death experience after that. So maybe I had an easy access to that place. So I remember that. But since I study with Dan, he is very much into bring this back. Yeah. You know, this is bring this back as you are. And that's my inclination. You know, I'm really, as a psychologist, as a environmental social activist, I'm really interested in bringing it back.
Right.
And, you know, living from this place of love. But it has to come from this wider perspective. Otherwise, we just get burned out.
Yes. Yes. Thank you for that. I think people like me who get glimpses of it, not out of, like, we're victims or anything, but sheerly out of a lack of any kind of discipline like people like you have, but enough glimpses of it to be like, oh, that is amazing.
Yeah.
I think it's good for people to hear that when you talk of the bodhisattva vow pops up, which is we're going to forego this possibility until all beings are liberated. They're not saying it as though there's they haven't found access to that place you're talking about. It's yeah. almost something built into at least Tibetan Buddhism to keep people engaged in the world, in the sense that there is such a possibility of just blinking out. And this is in near-death experiences. And I don't know if this is what you experience, but one of the recurring themes when people are dying is that they don't want to come back. Right. It's like sometimes the way one of my children feels about preschool, you know, some days he doesn't want to go. And like, it's a similar sense. Did you have that experience of not wanting to return mm-hmm. to this? Wow.
Yeah. I remember the next morning, and you know, that was 1980, and I didn't know what was happening to me. I was just in this white space, really beautiful space. And the next morning I thought, oh shoot, here I am back again, you yes. know? And it was like, oh brother, here I am, you know?
Yes.
And so, yes, definitely I can feel that. And there is this little bit, I remember after long retreats, feeling this little bit of ache, you know, oh, I feel already homesick for the next time, you know. So
yes,
but then I personally also really have a love for people, and whether we really exist or not, you know. When in Tibetan Buddhism we talk about it's just a conceptualization, or
yes.
we are not really what we think we are, and who knows, you know. And but I think our pain, the pain my clients have in my office, or I have three children that are now young adults.
Wow.
That pain is, at least it feels awfully real.
Oh, yes.
And I think it would be really, when they say, you know, there's universal and there is mundane reality, or personal reality. And
yes.
maybe it's both true, but on a personal level, it really hurts.
Absolutely.
Now the world is hurting, you know?
Oh my, I feel so fortunate. My therapist didn't get enlightened all the way or decided to dissolve into infinity, because, you know, the spiritual advice I got from Ram Dass wasn't go meditate. He said, you need therapy. And I ignored it for years because I'm like, oh, come on, I want to do a mantra. But truly, it's the only, like, I mean, I love, you're making me feel a little bit of courage, because I don't even know why. No one, and especially in Buddhism, it's not like there's necessarily blasphemy. But, you know, one of my realizations have being in therapy is that this is helping me in ways meditation mm-hmm. has not, in a real
yeah.
down to earth, like memories that I'd forgotten that I needed mm-hmm. to address and all the stuff. So I love that you are, you know, upholding a new tradition that's forming right now, which is the tradition of Western psychology. And in a lot of ways, it's a very beautiful thing and a very good thing. And I think people feel like they're going to save money or something by going to meditate, because, you know, insurance won't cover therapy a lot of the time, you know. So people are like, look, I'll just get into meditation, and then nothing happens necessarily. And also, I love that you're pointing out that there is something good about the world, though sometimes I wonder. I hear these Tibetan invitations when you listen to the form of Buddhism that's for the monks.
Yeah.
Saying, leave your home, leave yeah. your family, leave it all behind, yeah. forget it all, take refuge, and just, you're done. You're done. And sometimes I hear that and wonder if the sentiment that you are reflecting, that Ram Dass reflects, that Jack Kornfield reflects, that a lot of the heart-based teachers reflect, which is, this is a school. This is a place where we're growing, evolving, and yeah. learning. And we're here to help take the curriculum. There's a million different versions of it. Sometimes I wonder, is that just attachment? Is that just another way of tricking yourself into staying connected to the world mm-hmm. and the dream of being a self?
Yeah,
I wonder what your thoughts on that.
Yeah, isn't that a little bit, though, a mind... how would I say, a mind, how do I say that politely?
Don't say it politely. You can call me an idiot. I'm fully comfortable with that. Jack Kornfield called me a public neurotic.
Is that a mind fuck, right? And so you can edit that out if you want, or you can keep it in.
You can curse on this podcast, but thank you for being polite.
And so, see, I don't know. Maybe I'm just kind of agnostic. When I'm okay knowing that I'm just human, and maybe I can't wrap my mind around it. But the Dalai Lama was once asked, how does he cope with all the suffering that happened to Tibetans in Tibet, you know, with the Chinese taking over?
Yes.
And being without a country. And I took my kids actually 3 times to Dharamsala, and we worked with people who just came out of Chinese prisons and taught English, and it was a great experience for them. You know, they were teenagers. And so he said, I trust in the sincerity of my heart's intention. I trust in the sincerity of my heart's intention.
Yeah.
I think, you know, we don't know really what to trust, you know, right or left or up and down or this book or that book, but we can trust in the sincerity of our heart's intention.
Right. Right. Yeah. It's like a North Star or something. It's a And it's in the, and like, I can feel that. I know what that is. I know exactly what you're talking about. And that isn't a void, or that isn't something that's sort of, that would want to go off into the nothingness. I see that. I see that. And, you know, again, not to push the point too much. I mean, this is one of the paradoxes and beautiful aspects of the systems that show up in Buddhism. This sort of systematic dissolution of identity up until you get the Heart Sutra, which is all, you know, saying actually this also is empty too.
Yeah.
You know? And so, and again, I agree with you. It's a mind fuck. Most importantly, it's just like playing a game with your mind or something like that. But still, even that heart's intention, isn't there some possibility that the thing that that's really just the last thing keeping you connected to ignorance? That's the last thing keeping you connected to the world? And in the same way, like, you first stumble upon the Dharma and you think, no way, my thoughts are my thoughts. You work with your thoughts long enough, you're like, I don't think those are me. I don't know what it is, but it's not me. And similarly, my body is my body. Well, I certainly have a different body than I did years ago, so I'm some kind of weird river of body, but I can't say this thing that I am isn't static.
Yeah.
And you know, and over time, though, you become more and more comfortable with it until you get to that kind of thing where even that, couldn't that also just be sort of a delusion, a way to connect to the dream? Sure. I'm sorry to go nihilist on you here. I'm looking for a correction.
Well, yes, it might be going a little bit into nihilism, but I think one of the ideas is, and also the experiences, that an aspect of this field of awareness is love. You know, there are the qualities of luminosity, of knowing, of formlessness, of timelessness, but also of love, which is not just personally there, but it's a priori, it's already there. And if you really rest in that field, then it's there. It's not cold, you know, it's not down. And you know, honestly, I often wonder, what is the heart? Actually, the Christian mystic who I got to know here at some point, Cynthia Bogo, do you know her?
No, I don't.
She's a very non-dual Christian mystic. And she calls the heart the organ of psycho-spiritual connection. And
Wow.
I hear that quite often, you know, the heart is, it's physical, it's energetic, it's electrical, it's magnetic, it's the what connects the particular with the universal. But I can't really wrap my mind around it.
Yeah.
But I feel there is something there. And so how can we have, and I think Ram Dass was amazing with that. He had
Yes.
this love that wasn't just, oh, I like you. You know, that was that love that was already there.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Yes. I mean, this is, yeah. And I don't want to keep going on and on, but I don't even care. Who cares if I'm wrong? That this is the thing. So what? So you believe in love and what? So you were wrong. You shouldn't have been kind to people. You shouldn't have been helping people. Everything was nothingness. It was some weird dream or something. So what? What do you got to lose? You know, you helped a lot of people in this waking dream. So I think if you're going to put, you know, bet on something, I'm going to bet on love over annihilation any day of the week. And because the result of that produced, you know, that creates a certain way of being in the world that I think if more people were just, you don't even have to believe in it. You know, I think that's where people get confused is they think, oh, I don't feel love. I don't feel anything. I'm numb from the neck down. Yeah. I've been there. You know what I'm talking about, right? People are numb from the neck down. And so they hear this love stuff and they're like, whatever. I don't even know what you're talking about. That's ridiculous. But I think you don't have to necessarily have an experience of it necessarily. I think there's a way for potentially even sociopaths to put their money on love and just wing it all the way through. What do you think?
Well, I think, you know, we know about sociopaths that they are really traumatized. You
yeah.
know, when... That's one thing we know from research. So I think if your eyes are clouded or, you know, you have dust on your eyes, as the Tibetans say, to a degree, then it's hard to really see what is there. And I think the more we kind of, in some ways, meditation, whether it's the moment by moment kind or the resting in the field kind is the sensitivity training.
Yes.
You know, we are becoming more and more sensitive to ourselves, to others, to life. And, you know, I think in Mahamudra Dzogchen, one of the very high teaching is to see that everything is sacred.
Yes.
You know, everything is lively awareness. Empty. What
yeah.
is it in the Heart Sutra? Emptiness is form and form is emptiness, right?
Yes.
And so to see everything as sacred, and I just remember being in Dharamsala and there were these cave yogis that lived forever in these caves somewhere in the mountains. And sometimes they would come into town and they were just beaming.
Whoa.
And they wouldn't be cold and aloof. They were just, wow, you know, it's like, I want that, you know.
Yep. Yeah, I saw one of them once when I was in Dharamsala. I know what you're talking about. You're just, I know exactly what you mean. They're definitely not the way I had pictured them. This is the only reason I bring up the sociopath thing. And we talked about it before the podcast. The sort of, and Jung does talk about this, the shadows
yeah.
projection on the global stage in this current world events that we're all experiencing. It makes me think we need someone to come up with a way to articulate Buddhism to sociopaths, you know, a way to get people, because, you know, my friends who are psychologists, they... one of them we often talk about, well, actually, you know, the qualities of a sociopath work very well as the president mm-hmm. of, I'm sure you've heard this, it works very well as an executive, works very well as a president, works very well as a leader who has to kill people or fire people or make decisions that destroy people's lives. You can't really be heart-based and successfully pull off invading another country or any of the things that we're witnessing. Do you think, you know, and this is why I'm bringing up sociopaths, but generally, and I love that you're compassionate enough to say, well, sociopaths have a lot of trauma. Mm-hmm. Because generally they get kind of brushed off as some kind of not even human thing, like a praying mantis disguised as a human. But do you think there is some way to Zog Chin, do the instantaneous, whatever it may be, some possibility of zinging in the dharmic throwing star into the consciousness of some of these people so that it just doesn't work what they're doing anymore? That there's some way that they reconsider everything?
I don't know. I don't think we can manufacture that. You know, when you brought up Jesus before, you know, there is the Saulus turns Paulus story.
Yes.
You know, who was this Roman soldier or whatever he was, and he fell off his horse and lightning struck and he was changed. So we know stories like that. And, you know, we don't know how that works together with what we talked about in the beginning, with karmic seeds.
Yes. Yeah. You know? Right.
So we don't know, but we know that at the core of every LERP is trauma, and or earlier traumas can be triggered when outside circumstances occur.
Right.
You know, so if people have been really wounded, then maybe, who knows what gets reignited. You can either really shut down or you can either really open up.
Right. Right. You know, chatting with you about this makes me think somehow we have created the perfect condition for never-ending war by producing a system within which trauma-ridden people with not a little bit of trauma, not the kind of trauma I'm dealing with therapy, which I wouldn't call a little bit, but it's not like I'm, you know, I'm not numb from the neck down, unfortunately, though sometimes I wouldn't mind it so much. But we've produced a system where numb from the neck down people, they're the ones who end up running countries. And if what you're saying is true, they're riddled with these time bombs that are certain to go off according to some kind of rotten pressure, meaning that as long as that system is in place, we can only expect never-ending war, right? Because our leaders are like walking minefields, riddled with unexplored trauma that they've confused as their strength. And so this seems like maybe this is just part of being a human, is that built into human civilization is this never-ending conflict.
Yeah, and you know, I think for the first time, and the movie Don't Look Up really made that clear,
right,
that we are now endangered as a species, as a human species. So that's, in a way, the first time that that's happening. And
right,
there is an opportunity in that, you know, that might have a certain, that could bring up more awareness, or it may not, we don't know. But, you know, I wrote once an article that was actually published in Lines about Sisyphus. Did you ever hear about Sisyphus?
Oh, I love the myth of Sisyphus. Camus' Myth of Sisyphus.
Yeah,
yes. Exactly. Some people listening might not know, though, so maybe you could quickly.
Yeah, I will. So
thank you.
Sisyphus was the Greek hero who had, because of whatever he did, he was condemned to roll the stone up the hill forever, ever, and ever. And then the stone would always roll down again. And so often he was seen as the hero of futility, you might
yes.
say. And then Camus, existentialist, actually one of my heroes. I love Dr. Rieu and I love Sisyphus. And so Camus said, how about we see Sisyphus differently? Yes. We see that Sisyphus finds meaning in the moment, in the phenomenon of rolling the stone up the hill. And what does he do when he walks down the hill as he rolls the stone back up the hill? And just really gets his meaning in the moment.
Yeah.
Regardless of outcome. And then in my article, which I'm glad to send to you, I said,
please,
how about we see Sisyphus as a bodhisattva? You know, it's not just my personal stone. It's the stone of human existence that
right.
we roll up this hill again and again and again. And maybe like a hospice or palliative care doctor, we make ourselves a little bit free of outcome. You know, we roll the stone because we roll the stone, and we do it
yes.
with presence and with love, and that's it.
You're making me think of the Lojong mind training. One of the phrases is abandon all hopes of fruition.
Right.
This has got to be Sisyphus's mantra, right? Like, there's no fruition from rolling the stone. Nothing's coming of it. And you know, the hope of fruition is torturous, isn't it? When not just from the perspective of my own spiritual path, God knows I can't have any hope, but certainly when we're looking at the world, you know, the sense inside of us, those who have felt their heart and the terrible realization, my God, if more people felt like this, I think the planet would look completely different than it does now. And then the reality where you look out and you're like, oh yeah, no. Nothing's going to change, is it? And that hurts. So maybe, yeah, I love that. Seeing this, a human society, it's kind of grim, but I guess you could say Camus was slightly grim in his own way.
Yeah.
Beautiful, but something grim about abandoning, about giving up any hope.
But you can do it from a, you know, if you're actually coming back to awareness, if you found out the secret of resting in awareness, you know, then it's not so grim, you know, because you don't feel so grim inside. You feel interconnected with the web of life.
Right.
And then you walk through maybe the battlefield from that perspective.
Right.
And you don't expect that you can fix everything or anything.
Right. Because that's not your job, is it? Is that's not all these people out there think
no,
they can fix everything?
I could, but I can't.
Right. Yeah. Well, it's everything. It's broken. Wow. Wow. I'm trying to be sensitive to your time. It's 4:50. I know that you have an appointment. Well, my time, it's 4:50.
Oh,
your
that's
time.
Fine. I can go until the hour because. My people come here to me, but let me turn this phone off. One sec.
Thank you.
See, because I changed rooms, I had
yes.
a phone that wasn't turned off. So now it's turned off.
Well, I love that we have gone completely global in our discussion of trauma. And I think mm-hmm. that's wonderful. I need things like that just because I'm hooked on the news and I have to stop watching it because I do feel like it's, I don't think it's doing anything for me or most people. But can we, for the last little bit of the podcast, can we bring it back to
okay.
the
heart medicine?
Yes, to heart medicine and to some ways that people who are interested in what you're talking about are people who are becoming aware of these seeds. And I'm sorry to ask you for some in 10 minutes for some simple methodology of mm-hmm. healing trauma from your perspective.
Okay.
But can you give us some things that we could at least start looking into to begin to work with these seeds?
You know, the basic mindfulness practice is very effective. You know, because it gives us a way to know that there's an inner besides an outer. There is a balance which we can cultivate inside of ourselves. I think self-compassion is hugely important because, you know, we can really get get on our case? Why
Yes.
did you not get over this? Why am I still triggered by this?
Yes.
Why don't I just let this one off me? Why did I overreact like this? Why did I make this mistake? You know,
are you reading my thoughts? This is literally what I was thinking.
Yeah.
This is the litany of my thoughts. This is it.
Yeah. So in a way, having this kind of sense of warmth and you know, kindness towards ourselves and then also towards others for our human condition and for, you know, we are just humans. And maybe even forgiveness, you know, letting ourselves off the hook, not whitewashing, not condoning, but not holding grudges towards ourselves or others forever. It's too hard. Life is too hard to hold grudges. So that really helps. And then, you know, the practices of being with our pain, the felt sense of our pain and knowing when we really, like when we start to get into this rumination thing, to say, how does it feel in the body? You know, oh yeah, maybe a tightness in the chest or something knocked us in the stomach. And to just kind of hold that and keep breathing and then it will just pass by. And I think I described that really a lot in my first book, Hard Work, The Path of Self-Compassion. I really went into that. And then I think also holding the wider perspective, letting the mystery in is really important to learn to do that.
Right.
So because it's like, you know, Jack Kornfield has this image of if I put a spoonful of salt into a glass of water, it's very salty.
Yes.
And when I put a spoonful of salt into a lake, it's not salty.
Yes.
So if we make the container wider, the psycho-spiritual container, as I call it, then we come from this wider perspective. And maybe as last thing, I would say service. Serving others, sharing our healing sets us free.
Whoa. Do you think that service, sharing your healing, telling people how it's working? That I've never thought of that as, wow.
You know, are the fruits of our healing. You know, because I was in this orphanage, because my relatives maybe weren't so kind, because I went to therapy, I'm now more able to be compassionate with others who maybe felt rejected or left out or
abused.
You know, it doesn't mean I have to tell them about my story incessantly, but I understand.
Yeah.
You know, my heart space becomes bigger because of, you know, so, and then to be there for others, whether it's your neighbor or your child or somebody at work or in your activist group or wherever that is. And I think service sets us free because it makes us, in a way, less self-involved. We know that we have some kind of efficacy or strength, that we have courage.
Yes.
We are interconnected. We are basically services interconnection in progress, you know.
Interconnection in progress. I love that. 4 minutes. This is an important question, though, and I'll make it quick. If we haven't mastered self-compassion, for me, it's the hardest thing. I can summon up compassion for other people, or at least fake compassion for other people. But if we haven't fully mastered this compassion you're talking about, is it phony to then go into the world and try to do the service that you're talking about? Is it necessary to figure out the self-compassion thing first before extending it out into the community like you're talking about?
I think it's a work in progress. You can do it side by side. You know, this whole thing, I have to first do this, that I can do that. I don't quite believe in that.
Okay.
Because we can kind of get stuck in solipsism or, you know, self-involvedness forever. But I think side by side. Side by do things by side by side.
Thank you so much. And I'm so grateful to you for your patience. I'm sorry about the scheduling issue. It is such a, I'm so excited to read your article. And I'm so lucky to just get any time with you at all. Thank you very much. Can you please let people know where they can find, how they can connect with you?
Yeah, there are a few ways. One is I started a nonprofit, and we teach now mindfulness and heartfulness in schools. And we have this meditation wow. platform. It's called mindfulheartprograms.org. Mindfulheartprograms.org. And we teach a lot of the resting and awareness as it's bridged with, you know, the mindfulness we know. And then my personal website is RadhuliWeininger.com. And can always email me, Radhuli@gmail.com. That's fine.
What? Thank you for that. That's a very generous thing to give your email out. Wow. Thank you, Radhuli. This has been a joy chatting with you. All the links you need to find her will be at DuckettRussell.com. Hare Krishna, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
That was Radhuli, everybody. All the links you need to find her are going to be at DuckettRussell.com. A big thank you to our wonderful sponsors, and thank you for listening. I'll see you in a couple of days. Until then, Hare Krishna.